We're anxious to hear from Darian DeLu about the U.S. Peace Coalition delegation to Venezuela. But first, we'd like to introduce tonight's featured presenter, Hallie Hawkins, a former Green Party candidate for office from New York State, who coined the phrase Green New Deal, which we've all been hearing a lot about. There's a lot of hope around that phrase, along with a lot of criticism from hardliners on the right. Dollars for war are easy to come up with, or a new border wall, or nuclear weapons. But when it comes to doing the right thing environmentally to address climate change, that's another story. Jot down any questions for Hallie for question and answers as he speaks. Good evening, Hallie, and welcome to One Wealth. Many of our branches are represented on this call, along with a number of at-large members. I hope you can tell us how and when you came up with the term Green New Deal, how what you envisioned compares to what's being discussed today, and maybe suggest some ways that we can support a version of the Green New Deal that really might work. Your mic is open.
Well, thank you. That's really the order in which I wanted to present this. I first campaigned for a Green New Deal for New York in 2010 when I was the Green Party candidate for governor. And at that time, we saw it as a way out of the, we're coming out of the Great Recession. So sometimes we phrased it the Hawkins Prosperity Plan versus the Cuomo Austerity Plan. You know, he wanted not to tax the rich. He wanted a freeze on public employees, cut spending on education and so forth, even a furlough for some state workers. And so what we were talking about was completing the full promise of the original New Deal, which would have been FDR's third New Deal. And he articulated that in the 1944 State of the Union Address when he called for an economic bill of rights and asked Congress to enact it. And we picked up on five of those rights: a job guarantee, public jobs for the unemployed, a guaranteed income above poverty, homes for all through expanding public housing and rent control, Medicare for all, and lifelong public education, tuition-free pre-K through college. And the green part of the Green New Deal was public investment in clean energy as a way to both deal with the climate crisis, but also as an economic stimulus to get us out of the Great Recession. So that was the core idea that we campaigned upon. But, you know, this didn't come from nowhere. I mean, I've been involved in these issues since I was active in the Clamshell Alliance, the Anti-Nuclear Alliance, back in the 1970s, and worked closely within that movement with Richard Grossman of Environmentalists for Full Employment, and later Tony Mazzocchi from the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, you know, whose people were trying to get out of these toxic industries like nuclear power and weapons. And so, you know, out of that came the Superfund for Workers, or what we today call a just transition for workers who are displaced by this transition from fossil fuels and nuclear power to clean energy, and also from military production to civilian production. So, you know, we were working on that in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. The Green Party got started, and I almost put Green New Deal in a platform plank I wrote in the 2000 for the 2000 Green Party USA platform, but I couldn't quite say New Deal because it was associated with the Democrats. So we called for a global Green Deal and basically spending the peace dividend, which we were still hoping to get, you know, 9 years or so after the East Bloc collapsed. It was about providing basic needs and clean energy and being the world's humanitarian superpower, which Ralph Nader was calling for. And then in 2008, the UK Green Party, the Green Party of England and Wales, came out with a paper for a Green New Deal, detailed plan involving economic recovery. We're now in this recession through clean energy, bank regulations, more progressive taxation. And Caroline Lucas, who was a Green member of the European Parliament, advocated that and then took it to the European Greens. And by the next year, the UN Environmental Program was calling for a global Green New Deal. And they were talking about global recovery through clean energy, bank regulation, more progressive taxation. And then the European Greens campaigned on it. They talked about it as being green modernization in the face of economic crisis. So green investments instead of bank bailouts. And so that was, in the air. And so then the Greens asked me to run for governor, and I said, let's run on this Green New Deal. And a lot of Greens are saying, no, that sounds too Democratic Party. We're the alternative. But I argued that a lot of progressive Democrats are disappointed in the Democrats. And, you know, if we bring it back up, this economic bill of rights, some of them might vote for us. And so it caught on, and by the end of the campaign, it caught on nationally. We had 61 Greens around the country sign on to a release calling for a Green New Deal. And the Greens also had me run in 2010 and 2014 and 2018. In 2010 and 2014, the Green part really narrowed around the demand for a ban on fracking, which we did get after the 2014 election in New York State. And then we came around to 2018. The big issue was the Greens had a bill that we got some legislators to put in to go to 100% clean energy by 2030, and the fight was with the progressive Democrats, who have a bill for 100% by 2050, which we think is too late, according to the climate science, which is really a decade old now, making that point. And so after the 2018 campaign, the Sunshine Movement, these young folks, went down to Representative Pelosi's office and demanded a Green New Deal. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez showed up, and she's getting a lot of attention, and she endorsed them, and it went national in a big way, which is great. It's really good that Ocasio-Cortez kept the link between economic and climate security, because I think that's the only way we can build the political coalition that will get both done. Because if people don't feel economic security, they're not going to take risks on changing the energy system. What happened, unfortunately, is that Pelosi sliced, diced, and disposed of the Select Committee for a Green New Deal, which is what the original proposal was. First, Pelosi said, well, you can't have subpoena power. And then she said, you can't submit legislation. You got to go through the other committees. And then finally said, we're not going to do it. We're going to have a climate committee like we had before. And then Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey came up with a non-binding resolution for a Green New Deal to get these politicians on the record. But Pelosi won't bring it to the floor. McConnell did bring it to the Senate, but then the Senate Democrats, four of them voted against it, and the rest voted present. So they didn't want to go on the record. So that's unfortunate, but it is an issue of debate in the presidential campaign, and it's still on the agenda. So I think it's incumbent upon all of us, you know, Sunshine Movement, Green Party, Wilf, everybody, to keep pressing for discussion on this issue. So, you know, the question is, what should be in the Green New Deal? And I could go into detail where I think, you know, Markey and Ocasio-Cortez weren't clear enough, like on banning all new fossil fuel infrastructure, and that nuclear power is not clean energy. But the basic points are there. Now, what I'm working with a group of people and an economist is to have an expanded and an eco-socialist Green New Deal. Expanded because we can't even get to 100% clean energy without conversion of all the production systems, including agriculture, transportation, manufacturing, urban design, and converting military production. And it needs to be eco-socialist for two reasons. One is we need public ownership of some key industries. Like, we can't leave the oil and gas industry in the hands of Exxon and the Koch brothers, because they're never going to reinvest their earnings in renewables. They're going to keep extracting fossil fuels. And the other reason is to coordinate the investments in converting all these production sectors. We need a system of economic planning, and that requires public ownership of key industries and banks, or at least some banks, so we can actually have a plan that we can execute. So I'm working on this budget, particularly with John Wren. I'm sure some of you remember Seymour Melman, who was the big peace conversion industrial engineer and also trying to get the manufacturing base. And John was his research assistant for 20 years. So we hope by next month to have a budget of what this is going to cost and where the money's going to come from that can be sort of a standard against which everybody running for president or talking about the Green New Deal has to measure up to. So it really involves two parts, the economic bill of rights, the five rights I talked about, pricing them out. Some of these programs are in the hopper in Congress. You know, the job guarantee, that's the old Conyers bill, Medicare for all for the comprehensive health care. Unfortunately, there hasn't been anything on public housing in decades, so that's something we really got to bring back to the fore. And then the second part is a green economy reconstruction program. So, of course, it's rebuilding the energy system. We're going for 100% clean energy by 2030. If we want, we can go into the climate science. I'll take a question on that if people want. And there are about a dozen sectors that we've got to convert. And I'm not going to hit all of them, but I'll highlight a few. One is buildings. We need to convert from natural gas or heating oil to heat pumps, ground source heat pumps or air source heat pumps. We need to put solar panels on all the roofs that have good exposure. And we need to do a lot of retrofitting for energy efficiency. And as part of a housing program, we can build green buildings. And they can actually be carbon negative. And it's not just an affordable housing program. It's a jobs program. It's a clean energy program. It could be a desegregation program if we had scatter site, mixed income, public housing that's high quality. So that would be a big program. That's what the Poor People's Campaign and before that, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom and the Freedom Budget that came out of that were calling for. Their big investment was, you know, they wanted 500,000 new housing units a year until all the slums were cleared. And we got to get back to that. Another crucial area is agriculture. Climate change aside, although it contributes to this, the insects are dying off. I mean, scientists, there were some reports last month about how in a couple decades they may be all, you know, they may be all gone. And that's due to pesticides as well as global warming and habitat loss. And if we lose the insects, ecosystems collapse and agriculture collapses. So that is another life or death issue we face. Peace conversion. I mean, we haven't talked about that for a couple decades now. I mean, back in the 80s and 90s, there were people from Ron Dellums on the House Armed Service Committee to Randall Forsberg over at MIT and other people were coming up with detailed plans about how we can reduce weapon systems and force structures. We don't have that now, and we got to do that research. And then, of course, the global Green New Deal. That's the peace dividend from military spending cuts being invested in getting the rest of the world, helping them get their basic needs met and going to clean energy. So this is going to be very expensive, and that's what we're pricing out. It's trillions of dollars. It's not $93 trillion like that right-wing think tank came up with the other day, which was just a fanciful figure. But it's going to require a lot of public investment and revenues for the operating programs and the Economic Bill of Rights. Those would come mainly from tax revenues, and then we need to have ways of financing the long-term green economy investments. So what we're looking at is military spending cuts on the order of 50% to 75%. Again, we would like to have more detail from, you know, what weapon systems do we cut, what force structures do we reduce, what military bases overseas do we close. You know, all I know is back in 89, I remember Robert McNamara and Lawrence Korb, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reagan, saying we could cut the military budget by 50%. Now that the Soviet threat disappeared. And they had the weapon systems and force structures outlined. You know, that's the kind of thing we don't have right now, unless you can tell me, and I've missed it. We need progressive tax reform and ecological taxes. We can raise a lot more revenue. And, you know, for example, on payroll taxes, why do we have a cap on the Social Security tax for the rich folks? More progressive income, wealth, corporate assets, estates that can all generate enormous amounts of revenue, and also provide tax relief to lower-income people who get hit so hard by the payroll tax. When you count the employer contributions, right off the top, 15.3% of wages go to payroll taxes. And, you know, people don't even pay that much until recently on their capital gains. As Warren Buffett pointed out, his secretary pays more in taxes, a higher rate than he does. And we need ecological taxes. We need to make the polluters pay and the depleters, the resource depleters pay. So that's taxes on land values, carbon, other pollution, and resource extraction. So we're going to price those out. And then for the investments, we need a system of public money and banks. Now, there's one proposal the Greens advocate. It's very radical. We would basically modernize the old greenback demand of the populist movement in the latter half of the 19th century and have the government issue greenbacks that are debt-free rather than bonding to create money like the Federal Reserve notes. That is a big step. But in the meantime, we can do what's called green quantitative easing. The modern monetary theorists talk about that. It's really traditional borrowing. The Fed creates money, buys treasuries, And eventually the Treasury has to pay back the Fed. Some of these MMT people think that money's free, but it's really debt money. But to make these investments, which we need to make, that's probably what we have to do. And the other thing we want to do is public banks, like the Bank of North Dakota. Those Republicans up there love their little socialist bank. It partners with the community banks. They have more community banks than anywhere else in the country. And they finance the farms, the homes, the businesses, student loans, you name it. And they can do it at lower cost because they're operating to make ends meet, not a profit for shareholders. So that's where we think the financing can come from. And I kept within 15 minutes, which is hard for me, but I'm glad I did it. So maybe we should stop now and take questions, and I'll try to answer.
Okay, well, Howie, you came up with some really, really neat ideas. And I know that many of them have been emerging from the Green Party for many years, both in the United States and Europe. There are exciting and innovative ideas that, of course, have been pretty much ignored. If our members have questions for Howie about any of the ideas or creative concepts he's talking about, you can get on the stack by pressing number one on your phone keypad. We already have two people with their hands up, but if you're interested in, if you made notes like I'm doing and have questions for Howie, press number one on your phone keypad. And our first question comes from Ann Henney. Ann, go ahead.
Thank you, Howie. That was amazing. I can't agree with you more about the need for radical redistribution of resources throughout our economy and society. I am very active in environmental issues, and one of the things that I see happening is a lot of conflict around the issue of so-called just transition. And obviously, it could be solved by investing in conversion of jobs and economies, but it's not right now. It's going to take a while. And so I'm curious if you have, you know, ideas for how to deal with that, where I see progressives kind of at each other's throats over trying to get rid of fossil fuels and, you know, also other progressives saying we can't do that because it hurts people who need the jobs.
Sure. The just transition that we're talking about is for any worker displaced by the conversion from fossil fuels or from military production or whatever it is, their income and benefits will be guaranteed for 5 years. In some cases, you know, like an older coal miner, you might just buy them a pension. The reality is, every study that's been done on a transition to 100% clean energy finds the bottleneck is not the technology, we got it. There's plenty of financial capital around to make the investments. The bottleneck is labor. Ross Geltzman did studies, he got some retired oil executives and some people from Harvard and MIT, and that's what they found. This was in the late 90s. Ross Geltzman was the editor and before that a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter with the Boston Globe. And more recently, Mark Jacobson, who's out of Stanford and has done a global study and a lot of studies for the different states and different countries, it's always the number of jobs that are created is more than the unemployment rate in that state. For example, in New York, the study was for 2013. It would create 4.5 million jobs building the system out over the course at that point of 17 years. And, you know, the unemployment rate was up because we were coming out of the Great Recession, but it wasn't that high. So the jobs should be there. But we do have to reassure people that they will be made whole throughout the transition. The other group of people that are concerned are communities that depend on the tax bases from fossil fuel or nuclear plants or defense plants, if we're talking about peace conversion. And what we got to do as part of the just transition is assure them that we will keep their tax revenues, you know, we'll fill up the tax revenues to the level they were getting as they make the transition to the new economy. And I think So that's the just transition. I think you were also getting at the environmental justice question. The, you know, poor communities that are excluded from jobs and education and, you know, isolated because they're segregated. And one of the things I want to see the Green New Deal is target the investments into these communities and have them developed under community control. With community control, the people that are, you know, oppressed by discrimination, racism, and so forth, what you got to do is disempower the racists by empowering those communities so they aren't subject to the decisions of racists, whether they're employers or real estate agents or judges or cops, anybody who's a gatekeeper and has the power to discriminate. With community control and providing the resources so that you can have, you know, real power, we can alleviate those problems and get environmental and racial justice. I've dealt with this. I'm a retired Teamster. I know a lot of people in the labor movement. And, you know, the staffers in particular are like, well, we don't trust you're going to do that. We had NAFTA trade adjustments. In fact, my region of New York had the highest per capita trade adjustments because of NAFTA, and they were not very helpful. I mean, there was some money for people that lost their jobs, but it really didn't keep them whole through the transition. And so that record is something that we've got to say, we're not going to do that, you know, stingy program. This is going to make sure everybody's whole. And so that it is a challenge.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I have a follow-up, but I'll wait till the end if there's time.
Well, if it's a follow-up and you want to do it right away, Anne, go ahead.
Well, I completely agree with those things, those suggestions, but they take a while. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and other reports have shown the urgency of climate change is severe enough that if we don't really drastically cut fossil fuel emissions in the next 12 years, we're going to be faced with much more catastrophic problems than we already are having. And so that need to transition away from fossil fuels is urgent. So I think my question went to how can we accelerate that in the given the reality of this transition needing to have a lot of money that isn't going to be freed up anytime soon.
Well, if we can get a program to, you know, rapidly transition to clean energy, I think it will be because we've got the people with us and they're demanding it. And I think the only way we'll get the people with us is if we are simultaneously getting Medicare for All, the job guarantee, public housing to, you know, provide more affordable housing. You know, people are being pushed out of a lot of cities right now, their old neighborhoods. I mean, those are the things that immediately affect people. We got to speak to those as if we're going to build the support for the energy transition. I think it's got to come together. If we say, well, this is more important because, you know, the world's crashing, the climate is crashing, you know, people are going to say, well, I can't worry about that. I got to pay rent or I need to find a job. So I got to pay that medical bill. So I think we got to bring it all together in one package. That, I think, is the only politically the only way we can get any of it passed.
Thank you.
Judy?
Hi. I was curious about which candidates do you see as the most important to sway to this position on the Green New Deal?
I don't know if we're going to be able to sway them. I'm thinking of the Democrats right now. I mean, Bernie Sanders is the best. You know, he had one of the best climate bill along with that woman from California that retired, Barbara Boxer. And I'm not sure what he's got in the hopper now. I know he's the only candidate among the presidential candidates who called for a national ban on fracking. I don't know if you heard yesterday, Trump was in Texas and he signed two executive orders to basically preempt states' ability to deny permits. We've won one fight here in New York. We're in the middle of another one, and now Trump just took it away from us. So let Governor Cuomo off the hook. And so I, in researching that, I made a statement today I saw that Bernie was the only one that had, you know, ever called for a ban on fracking. The DNC, I don't know if you heard back in August, they somehow they got a resolution passed the previous meeting, like in June, that they wouldn't take fossil fuel money. And they came back in August and said, oh, no, yes, we will. And we're still for an all-of-the-above energy policy, which means fracking the hell out of the country for oil and gas. So I think the important thing is to put the pressure on all of them. And, of course, when some of them start to emerge in the lead, you know, they become organizing targets because, you know, they'll be gaining momentum. I think the main thing, I think the Sunshine Movement, you know, by being very visible and getting a lot of people out and hitting strategic targets have really helped. And then, you know, everybody, every opportunity we get, whether it's letters to the editor or a candidate forum when they're in your state, you know, bring up the Green New Deal. And just keep pushing them. Make them deal with it. And then also the media. Remember, in 2016, of all those debates they had, the climate issue never came up, not once. And so we've got to lobby the media saying, we want you to ask these questions.
Okay, next up is Nancy Price.
Hello, thanks. So that was a terrific presentation, Howie. So if we wanted to create a one-page double-sided handout, do you have such a document prepared now, or will one be prepared, or should we prepare our own? And can you think of perhaps creating some kind of timeline? I think if people could see not just the vision and what's so important about what you were laying out. I mean, it's really the way to go. But if there was a, because you had some caveats there about what could be achieved in terms of all the financial instruments, if people could see a sort of timeline so that they could really not only support the vision, but they could see that there are these benchmarks that might, could be, or are being pledged to be achieved. I think that could help because we're stuck in this two-year Congress and four-year presidential, timeline where policies change so quickly. So if this could be sort of mapped out time-wise, I think that might be very helpful. And secondly, I wanted to just say that here in California where I live, we have a very strong public banking bill that is going through the California State Legislature right now, and it will be heard on April 22nd in the first committee of the California State Assembly. We sent an action alert to all the California WILF members. So those of you on this call, please look at that action alert and make the calls that we request you make. If we can get this bill through the Assembly and into the Senate, Gavin Newsom is very supportive of California public banks. And if we could liberate the enormous amount of money in the California system into a public bank, it would be a fabulous advance, set an example for the rest of the states, and liberate money for this kind of just transition to begin in California. So thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Odile, you have your hand up. Go ahead.
The members that are working on Proposition 1. Proposition 1 is an economic conversion proposition. And I wonder if we cannot find a larger coalition that is working on peace conversion, because we're not going to get any money for the Green New Deal and for the environment in general, unless we start divesting from the military. So do you think there will be the forming of a much broader coalition?
Okay, if I understand the question, there's Proposition 1 in some state that calls for economic conversion. Is that the content?
Proposition 1 was passed in Washington, and it was introduced by many years by Eleanor Holmes Norton.
Eleanor Holmes Norton.
It's stop nuclear and start economic conversion.
And it calls on the federal government to act? Is that
yes.
the thrust of okay.
Yes.
That's one way, I think, to promote economic conversion. And, you know, the vote in the state gives us an opportunity to make the case for conversion. I think that's a good approach. And going back to the previous comments, you know, I've got dozens of releases and, you know, videos from my campaigns about the Green New Deal. We never did a two-page handout, but I think it's a great idea and a good way to summarize this work I'm doing with John Wren on the budget for a Green New Deal, as well as the timeline. Now, we have done that in legislation here in New York. The bill that the Greens helped write to get us to 100% clean energy by 2030 has benchmarks within the bill. Every 2 years, first of all, every county and every city over 50,000 has to have a climate action plan for their community to get to 100% clean energy by 2030. They have to report every 2 years. No building can be less or more than carbon neutral by 2020. All cars have to be zero emission by 2025. So we have benchmarks in that legislation, and I think that's a great way to you know, present the Green New Deal in, you know, when we say 100% by 2030, what are the intermediate goals? We also have goals for clean energy within that New York off fossil fuels bill. And there is a U.S. off fossil fuels bill, which has a goal of 2035. And I have not read that. I don't know if the benchmarks are in there or whether it's more of an aspirational kind of bill. But if they're not, they should be. I think that's a very good point that people see that it's a real plan. I think just by putting the timeline and the benchmarks in there, people see that it's real. And you can also hold the government to account when they, you know, pass the legislation. A lot of times we get bills passed and they're not implemented or enforced. And so, you know, getting the vote and getting it signed is sometimes just half the battle.
Okay, we also have questions coming up from Eileen Krakowski. Go ahead, Eileen.
Oh, thank you. My question has been answered. I love your vision, Howie. Thank you. That's it.
Okay. Ellen Thomas?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, I came in late, and I'm sorry that I missed your presentation. I hope I have a chance to listen to it later. Since Odile brought up the subject of Proposition 1, since I was in on the ground floor of it, I would be happy to answer any questions you might have about it. And there's a brief description that I put at the very top of the text pad, Howie, if you want to copy-paste that. And I'm et@prop1.org if you'd like to get in touch with me. And that, not just Howie, everybody.
Okay, thanks, Ellen. I also have Laura Dewey up with her hand up. Go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. What unions, if any, or major unions, are backing the Green New Deal? And the one of the unions who have not backed it, which ones are persuadable?
Well, the San Francisco Labor Council just passed a resolution in favor of the Green New Deal. I think it was earlier this week or last week. There is a group called Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, which Sean Sweeney in New York City coordinates. And these are all over the world. And they are generally favorable to the idea of renewable energy. They believe that we need public ownership of, you know, the oil industry and power utilities in order to get there. So some of those affiliates, if you look up Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, you'll see who's involved. I'm more familiar with New York State, the nurses and some of the service employee locals have been favorable to these to this kind of climate legislation in particular. There's a labor group called Labor Network for Sustainability, and those are not representing locals or unions or internationals, but labor activists, and I'm part of that. And they have a lot of good material and are working inside the labor movement to bring people along. I was in the building trades for the Teamster. Those unions are really tough, but the actual carpenters and masons and glazers and whatnot, they're into clean energy. I mean, I actually organized a worker co-op that did that in the late 70s and early 80s before Reagan pulled away the tax credits to the high-end folks that were putting in their solar and wind and getting energy efficiency retrofits. But tradespeople, you know, that actually do the work and are not union officials, often are very much in favor of this stuff. Even people that work, you know, like in the frack gas rigs. I've run into a lot of those guys. They're working in Pennsylvania, but it's close to the New York border. And when I'm in the Southern Tier, I've run into them, and they're all for clean energy. They got a dirty, dangerous job. And if they could do the same thing in a cleaner industry, they'd be happy to. So I think a lot of this has to be done at that level. The staffers is like, you know, the business agents, they just want to get their people working. And so, you know, it's like a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. So to them, the Green New Deal is those two birds out in the bush, and they already got a bird in their hand. That's the difficulty we face. And, you know, that's, you know, going back to environmentalists for full employment in the 70s, you know, we've been fighting that battle all along. But I think we've made progress. And a model for us should be the Australian building trades. They've done green bans. They won't build certain things that are dirty. And they have enormous influence in the environmental movement there. Different kind of labor culture. But it's something we can work towards.
Okay, great. And Michael Ippolito has a question for you, Howie.
Hi, Howie. Thank you for a great presentation. I just wanted to ask you, when you were talking about funding the Green New Deal, I actually also was going to mention, you know, the Norton bill for conversion economy, going away from nukes to funding, you know, green sustainability, which is written right into the bill. But also I was going to mention to you, you had mentioned before, I've heard you speak on apportioning the money, as is done with the military spending. And it's interesting because no one's ever questioning, you know, how we spend, how the United States government spends money on the military. So, you know, they don't say, hey, we need a payroll tax for a new generation of bombers or, you know, for, you know, invading this country or that, which is just, you know, lunacy. So when it comes to doing things people-centric, like, you know, the Green New Deal, what's your take on having Congress apportion the money, and so forth? If you could comment on that, please. Thank you. Check.
Well, yeah, they need a budget that appropriates money for the things that people need and not so much for the things that are destructive. And that is, you know, that's one reason I'm working on this budget, so we have something to show what it would look like. And you're right, you know, they will appropriate money for military, like, you know, they'd pass a military budget during the Iraq War, and then they'd pass a supplemental just for the war. And unfortunately, Pelosi would get that voted on in the spring, so it didn't become a campaign issue. And that's the kind of thing we got to watch and fight against. And it's really just a matter of getting priorities straight and demanding that, you know, these people adhere to our priorities or we get new people in there.
You know, Howie, I've often thought that the part of the problem is kind of what Nancy was saying, that if people could envision what a world that works this way would look like, kind of a Harry Potter world view, where we could actually see how it would work. If that world were suddenly today, what would our jobs look like? What would our transportation look like? What would our schools look like? What would our water and air quality look like? All of that would be, you know, so much easier for people to understand, you know. It requires a leap of faith if we don't have that vision.
Well, that makes me think of pictures, you know, are worth 1,000 words, and just pictures of what it would look like. I ran one campaign for mayor here and had an architect draw up both a sort of map-like plan of how the city would change and then some vision drawings. Man, oh, man, those vision drawings is what attracted people and got them excited. And I'm thinking, you know, that's something we should bring into this campaign for a Green New Deal. You know, what would our cities look like? What would our rural areas look like? You know, when we think of problems in cities, we think of slums. When we think of problems in rural areas, we don't think about it that much, but there's, you know, depression and people, you know, leaving because they can't make a living where they came up. And farmers are really over the rock right now, over the barrel, because the costs of production are not being met. So, I mean, that brings up the question of parity pricing. The farmers I've been talking to about the Green New Deal who advocated, one of them who lives up near me said, she wrote an article that was in Counterpunch that said, you know, regenerative or organic agriculture farmers should support the Green New Deal. And I told her the title should be the Green New Deal should support those farmers because they're kind of not thought about. But in any case, if we had, you know, just pictures of that, you know, see a revitalized small town with manufacturing based on agricultural feedstocks that are biodegradable and clean, you know, producing products from the food
or
fiber.
Or even if we just had one or two cities that were models that we could point to and say, look, it's working here. That might help.
Yeah.
So far, we're still trying to push for all of this.
Yeah, pieces in some cities around the world. You know, for example, free public transportation to encourage people to, you know, not use cars so much. And once you're doing that, you can restructure urban areas so they're walkable communities. You know, just pointing those examples, because, you know, a lot of times they'll say, oh, that's crazy, it'll never work. But if you can say, well, it's working in this city, then that just totally undermines their argument because it is working.
Okay, well, it's been a really good presentation, and we got a lot of really terrific questions from our people. I think we'll have to invite you back closer to the election campaigns, Howie, and see if you have more instructions for us or more marching orders. We're with you.
All right. I appreciate that, and I enjoyed making the presentation and talking with you.
Okay, thanks.